You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Alan Lynch is the current professor of International Relations and Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics at the University of Virginia and was director of research at UVA Center for International Studies from 2010 through 2012. He was also the director of University Center for Russian and East European Studies from 1993 to 2008, during which time he raised $1.5 million for graduate fellowships in Russian and East European Studies. Mr. Lynch has a PhD in political science from Columbia University in 1984 and a BA in history from the State University of New York Stony Brook in 1977, where he was also the All-American kicker-punter in 1975 in the 80-team National Club Sports Association. Alan Lynch spoke at the Wednesday, November 12, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Robert McGrath. Our podcast is entitled Vladimir Putin and the Crisis in the Ukraine, Policy and Personality. Here's Bob McGrath.
My name is Bob McGrath. I'm president of the organization. This organization has existed for about 25 years. As many of you know, our main function is to put on monthly programs on programs about public policy or political issues that are of interest to the region, to the Commonwealth, the nation, or the world. Today, obviously, we have a program of interest to about as globally as one could think. We love to have so many people attend these meetings. They're certainly open to the public, but I want to encourage any of you who don't yet happen to be members of Senior Statesmen to join up. The dues are quite reasonable. You get a free lunch, and you most importantly get to contribute your ideas to what would be good programs. So at the end of the period, if you see any of us with these blue name cards, just ask us what you need to do to become a member, and we'd love that. Now, it's my privilege to introduce our speaker, Alan Lynch. Alan Lynch is professor of international relations and Russian studies at the Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics here at the University of Virginia. At the university, he's also served as director of research at the Center for International Studies and as the director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies. Alan did his doctoral work at Columbia University and has a BA degree in history from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where I spent a lot of time, and where he was an All-American kicker-punter in 1975 in the National Club Sports Association. Professor Lynch has held positions at the Harriman Institute for Advanced Study of the Soviet Union, the Institute for East-West Security Studies, the Ferris Foundation of America, and the Graduate Institute of International and Developmental Studies in Geneva, Switzerland. He's been a visiting professor or visiting scholar at so many prestigious universities or research centers around the globe that I'm not going to list them all, but many of them are listed in the newsletter that we sent you. He's written many books with provocative and interesting titles. The titles include Vladimir Putin and Russian Statecraft, How Russia Is Not Ruled, Reflections on Russian Political Development, Does Russia Have a Democratic Future, Europe from the Balkans to the Urals, The Cold War is Over Again, Political and Military Implications of the Nuclear Winter Theory, and finally, the Soviet Study of International Relations. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and of course, in many, many scholarly journals. I particularly was interested that last summer I read a very interesting interview with Professor Lynch published in the Shanghai Daily News about Russian-Sino relations. He's been awarded the Marshall D. Schulman Award for Best Book by the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies. He's consulted widely for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the U.S. Air Force's Special Service School, the U.S. On-Site Inspection Agency, and the U.S. Army's National Grounds Intelligence Center up north of here. He's clearly a scholar, researcher, and teacher of wide renown. We couldn't have a more knowledgeable person to tell us about Mr. Putin and his and Russia's influence on Ukraine. Professor Lynch.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's good to see a number of old friends here. Jim Perkins is here, I know, in the back. Inga Hull can't be here today, but she also helped organize a number of events outside the Senior Statesman Group over the years. It's always nice to get an presentation like that, Bob. It's the kind of introduction that makes me wish my parents were here. My father, because he would be proud, but my mother in particular, because she'd actually believe it, you know.
She's Irish.
That's right. Now, can you hear me fine in the back, in the way back? All right. So what I propose to do in the time that we have, first, to just summarize the key events that have led us to the present moment in this crisis in Ukraine, this crisis of Ukraine, which is also a crisis of Russian-American and Russian-European relations as well. And then I want to ask the question, first, why is Ukraine so important to Russia? Secondly, how did we get here? And I'm going to advance a thesis, which I'll explain later. But the thesis is basically this. The current crisis in Ukraine, the crisis we've been experiencing basically since the end of last November, 2013, is the byproduct of two forces that have been building ever since the middle of the 1990s, long before Putin came to power in Moscow, and while Bill Clinton was still president of the United States. The first has to do with NATO expansion. That is to say, the progressive extension of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization eastward to include almost every former Soviet satellite ally in East Central Europe, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Romania, Bulgaria, as well as the three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, that had actually been part of the Soviet Union for half a century after Stalin forcibly annexed them in 1940. That's one tendency. So the progressive extension of NATO eastward toward Russia's frontiers. The second, which also predates Putin, is the clear determination of Russia's leaders that Russia should be the dominant international power on the territories of the former Soviet Union. They even have a term for this in Russian, and you don't need to know Russian to understand it. I'll say it in an American accent, Monrovskaya Doctrina. Monrovskaya Doctrina. Monroe Doctrine, Russian style. They use that term advisedly to legitimize activity, which they say, well, that's what the United States has been doing for 200 years in its own hemisphere. What's the difference? Okay? In Ukraine, these two vectors have come into a conflict that cannot very easily be resolved. The inexorable tendency of NATO to expand ever eastward toward Russia's frontiers, and the Russian determination to secure Russian influence along its historical borderlands. Borderlands that have been part of Russia's sphere of influence in one way or another going back 300 to 400 years. In the case of Ukraine, at least since 1654, when the crowns of Ukraine and the crowns of Russia were first joined in union. It was on the 300th anniversary of that date in 1954 that Nikita Khrushchev made one of his typically impulsive decisions and transferred jurisdiction of Crimea from Russia to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. No one really noticed it at the time, but I can assure you, in 1992, upon Soviet independence, the collapse of the Soviet Union, that is, and Russian independence, almost every Russian was astounded to realize that Crimea was no longer part of Russia, but actually part of Ukraine. All right? So keep this in the back of our minds. So what has happened? I could start back as far as 988 with the introduction of Christianity to what was then called Kievan Rus, or Kievan Russia, through the city of Kiev, the adoption of Orthodox Greek Christianity. But I'll skip 1,020 years and begin with 2008 as far as our purposes are concerned. I mentioned 988. I'll come back to it in terms of why Russia feels so intensively about Ukraine. In April of 2008, NATO held a summit meeting in Bucharest, Romania, one of its recent adherents. At that meeting, Ukraine and Georgia were identified officially as one day belonging to NATO. That one day, Ukraine and Georgia will belong to NATO. Now, there was no schedule given, no timetable, no action plan. That's because the Germans and the French were totally opposed. But the Americans were able to get the commitment in principle into the final communique. They had been warned confidentially months before by the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. You see him often on TV. He's ultra-professional. I've met him several times in the past. And Lavrov told the Americans, don't do it. If you go there, it will trigger reactions in Russia, which will have the effect of dividing Ukraine. Please don't go there. We went there. In August of 2008, you will recall the Russian-Georgian War, in which the Georgian nationalist leader Saakashvili, trying to get into NATO on the fast track, he had sent 2,000 soldiers to Iraq to get into the immediate Pentagon military assistance program. Clever move. A little too clever. He believed he could substitute the United States for Russia in terms of Georgia's security orientation. He walked into a carefully prepared Russian trap. He had opened fire on districts of Georgia that had been under de facto Russian occupation, in response to which the Russians brought an army of 10,000 to 20,000 troops within 24 hours through a tunnel into Georgia and dismantled the Georgian army in 5 days. That was a war against NATO expansion. That is where Russia drew its red line. 3 years later, I was in a conference in China, in Shanghai, and there were Russians as well as Chinese and Americans involved. And I remember a senior Russian official there stated to the shock of the crowd, thank God for the Russian-Georgian war. And even the Chinese were kind of dismayed. What does this mean? And then he said, because it means there won't be a Russian-Ukrainian war. In other words, for the Russians, the Georgian War of 08 was designed to send the message, this is Russia's red line. Privately, the Russians are saying, Ukraine is a triple red line. And I say to my students when they ask me my opinion, well, what do you think is more important to Russia, Georgia or Ukraine? They all get the right answer and go to the head of the class. Okay, so the Georgian War appeared, for the time being, to settle the issue. There would be no further NATO expansion for the foreseeable future. In 2010, a new Ukrainian president was elected, Viktor Yanukovych. This is the man who had been defeated in 2004 in the famous Orange Revolution, a contested election. There were thousands of European and American electoral monitors. He was Putin's man. He'd been defeated. He'd been forced to go through a runoff. There was corruption demonstrated. But he came back in 2010. One of the first things that he did was he extended by 25 years the lease of the Russian Navy on the Crimean port of Sevastopol, extending it to the year 2042 to reassure the Russians they need not fear anything within Ukraine as far as the security of their naval facilities were concerned. In exchange, Putin offered to provide natural gas to Ukraine at a much lower discounted price. He also, Yanukovych, reaffirmed Ukraine's neutrality. In other words, that it would not be joining NATO. And Ukrainian opinion in a large majority supported that position in 2010. At the same time, he was no simple Russian puppet. He was the president of a divided country, ethnically, linguistically, culturally. And he knew that if he decided unconditionally for Russia or unconditionally for the West, it would very likely split Ukraine. So he also said, we will not join Mr. Putin's Eurasian Union. Okay? This is 2010. A little bit later, Yanukovych agreed that he would sign on behalf of Ukraine an association agreement with the European Union. This would begin the process by which Ukraine would adjust its laws, its political institutions, its legal system, the market economy to European standards to prepare it eventually, in some distant future, for membership in the European Union. The Russians made it clear that they were not happy with this possibility, but Yanukovych reiterated his commitment. Through the summer of 2013, a year and a half ago, beginning last July, 2013, the Russians overnight embargoed Ukrainian exports to Russia. Russia is the major export market for Ukrainian industry, steel especially, and agricultural products. The Russians were sending a message. Think of the cost that you may pay in terms of your economic relations with Russia if you go headlong into an economic association with Europe that seems to exclude Russia or that does not take Russian interests into account. Interestingly, neither the European Union nor the United States said anything or did anything about this. Actions that were clearly illegal under the World Trade Organization that Russia had recently entered with the assistance of the Obama administration back in 2009, 2010. All right. Yanukovych was due to sign this agreement with the European Union in late November 2013. The Europeans presented a standard association package. Here's the deal, hundreds of pages of regulations. You have to introduce anti-corruption measures. You have to reduce your budget. You have to clean your house. Basically, a lot of short-term pain, economic pain. Yanukovych was up for re-election within a year, in exchange for which Ukraine would get $1 billion, a total of $1 billion in short-term financial help from the European Union. And the Europeans refused to discuss any way of squaring this association agreement with Russian-Ukrainian economic relations. All right. At the last moment, Yanukovych refused to sign the deal. He almost certainly would have been defeated, for sure, had he signed this deal, given the short-term economic pain associated with it and the limited resources that Europe was offering in return. Mr. Putin immediately came up with a $15 billion aid offer, 15 times as much, and a 25% reduction in the price of natural gas that Ukraine would pay Russia. It still imported 80%, 4/5 of its natural gas from Russia. Yanukovych took the deal without any public explanation of the shift, which triggered the first of the mass protests and demonstrations in Ukraine. Maidan Square in downtown Kiev was occupied by some 10,000 protesters, relatively small compared to later. Then in the west of Ukraine, protests emerged throughout vast swaths of the country as protesters occupied government buildings, city hall, governor's offices, in protest. Yanukovych's government could do nothing about it. He had lost effective jurisdiction over almost half the country. In early December, his police opened fire. There were deaths. Overnight, you had a multiplication of the protests. Where there had been 10,000, now there were hundreds of thousands. And increasingly armed and better armed over time, and increasingly radicalized, as will happen in violent confrontations over time. This is the crisis that lasts until about February 21st. So note first, Putin thought in late November that he had won his game, that he had found a way to protect Russian interests, economic and security interests, while also respecting formally Ukraine's sovereignty, right? He rejects the European deal, Yanukovych does, and accepts Putin's offer. That seemed to come apart in early December with the escalation of the protests and the violent element in it. It lasted 2.5 months until February 21st. On that date, envoys from Moscow and the European Union arrived in Kiev, and they negotiated a way out of the impasse. The deal would be accelerated elections, a transitional government, a move away from a presidential constitution toward a parliamentary constitution, but in the meantime, Yanukovych would remain president of Ukraine. The street, well-armed, increasingly radicalized, refused to accept that. Any deal that kept Yanukovych in power, and it was obvious. Yanukovych, in fear for his life, fled the country, probably rightly so. The deal collapsed, his government collapsed, and you had overnight a vacuum of power in Kiev. A government that now increasingly was committed to accelerating Ukraine's orientation westward toward Europe, and increasingly raising, again, the problem, prospect of Ukraine joining possibly NATO at some point in the distant future. It is only, in my judgment, at this point that Putin takes the decision basically to annex Crimea. In the fear that the vacuum of power in Kiev may see Ukraine as a whole gravitate out of Russia's influence, and therefore Russia must secure what it can while it can. That meant its naval rights in the Crimean Peninsula. Thus the Little Green Men, in a very efficiently orchestrated intelligence operation, caught Western analysts by surprise. He had mobilized large numbers of troops, perhaps 25,000, along the Russian-Ukrainian border in this area. That's where our friends uptown were looking at. Meanwhile, he was using the 25,000 Russian troops inside Crimea, already by treaty agreement with the Ukrainian government, to leverage the coup d'etat that eventually saw Russia annex Crimea by the end of March 2014. Putin had to be astonished at the ease and efficiency of the operation. He then escalates and begins to support secessionist movements in the far eastern Ukraine, where the ethnic Russian concentration of the population is the highest. These are mixed regions, ethnic Ukrainian and ethnic Russian, but the concentration of Russian speakers is highest along these southeastern borderlands. In Crimea, it was about 2/3 ethnically Russian. In the far eastern Ukraine, perhaps 40 to 50% in most regions, maybe higher in some of the large cities. So the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk rose up in revolt beginning in April. They've been in revolt ever since. At the end of May, there were elections held for president in Ukraine. They were won by the current president, Poroshenko. And for the first time in Ukraine's post-communist history, the vote was not split. There was no red and blue Ukraine. It was just all red, all for Poroshenko, in every district. That was a byproduct of Putin's aggressive tactics in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. Much to Putin's surprise, Poroshenko began a military offensive to retake these regions that had effectively seceded from Ukraine. And by mid-July, he had managed to divide these two areas from each other and was slowly encircling them. They were using aircraft to spot for artillery. That is to say, the aircraft identify where concentrations of enemy artillery are. They radio back the positions to base. The shooters, the gunners, calibrate their artillery, and with remarkable effectiveness. This was a huge surprise for Putin, who escalates in turn by increasing Russian military supplies to the east, and in particular, we are almost certain, including advanced surface-to-air anti-aircraft missiles, precisely to neutralize this military advantage that the Ukrainian government had with its aircraft. That's the missile that shot down the Malaysian airliner July 17th, 2014, in the far eastern region of Donetsk. It was a mistake. They thought they were shooting down a military aircraft. But this is the context in which that took place. For a time, it seemed that Putin was back on his heels. His isolation was increasing. He was now beginning to pay a serious price for advancing Russia's interests through these military interventions, direct and indirect. The Europeans, as well as the Americans, put economic sanctions on Russia. Those are serious economic sanctions now. But by the end of August, Putin had doubled down. He had sent about 4,000 or so Russian troops without insignia, without identifying marks, on the pattern in Crimea, into eastern Ukraine, well-armed, tanks, artillery, armored personnel carriers, well-disciplined, and professional troops. Over the Labor Day weekend, they were able to push back and reverse almost all of the Ukrainian army's gains since the late spring, reestablishing a front line that more or less has persisted to the present day. A ceasefire agreement was reached on September 5th, which, if carried out in its entirety, could be the basis of a settlement. Stop the fighting, withdraw heavy artillery, establish a buffer zone on the Ukrainian-Russian border with international monitors to make sure there are no violations, exchange of prisoners, decentralization of power from Kiev to these regions, and so forth and so on. This ceasefire has been very imperfect, in particular in the area around the Donetsk airport, which would be necessary for this region to have an independent international existence. They need direct access to Russia and to the outside world through air corridors. This is more or less where we stand today. Elections were held in the rest of Ukraine at the end of October. The pro-Russian parties got less than 8% of the vote. And then, about 10 days ago, elections were held in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, and predictably, the rebel leaders got 70 to 80% of the vote. The elections have therefore solidified a polarization through democratic legitimacy, an example of how elections can actually work against a liberal, tolerant presumption in politics if other preconditions are not set. The most recent news is based on European monitors on site, American, German intelligence, that the Russians have actually increased the supply of weaponry and troops across the border, that the rebels have made advances along this line, mainly to straighten out their front and to establish a more defensible position, all right, in the event of any future challenges by the government in Kiev. All right, that's the kind of thumbnail sketch of where we've been since this crisis really began in earnest about a year and a half ago. Why is the Ukraine so important to Russia? I want to begin with this symbol. This is the official emblem of the Russian state today. It harkens back to the official symbol of the Russian Empire before 1917. Look at the features. The double-headed eagle, taken from the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire, looking east and west. Russia as the inheritor of the Eastern Roman Empire. Two Romes have fallen, Rome and Byzantium. A third has arisen, Moscow. A fourth there shall not be. Okay, this is an ancient theme in Russian culture. St. George slaying the dragon. Christianity, Orthodox Greek, introduced to Russia through Kiev in 988. Okay? Kiev, known as, to Russians, the mother of Russian cities. The scepter and orb of power, legitimized through the church, the cross. Most importantly, three crowns. Three crowns for the three Russias. The three Russias. There is Great Russia, Russia. There is White Russia, or Belarus. And does anybody want to take a guess what the third crown is? It's Ukraine, or Little Russia, as Catherine the Great called it. Okay? So the idea of Ukraine is deeply embedded into Russian historical consciousness, political consciousness, and cultural consciousness. It is, for most Russians, unimaginable that Ukraine can somehow have an existence politically, institutionally, culturally, apart from, not to mention, in opposition to Russia. This is deeply ingrained, not just in Russian elites, but in Russian society as a whole. All right. Cultural and political significance. There is also a military significance. I'll try to explain this. These are the external borders of the old Soviet Union that include the south of Ukraine, Moldova near Romania, Georgia and Armenia in Central Asia, the Central Asian Muslim republics bordering Afghanistan and Iran. It includes Crimea. The Russians have considered since 1992 that their real security frontier is not the administrative borders of Russia, which in Central Asia are 1,000 miles further north than they were in the Soviet period, and without defensible natural boundaries. It is one great plains, the steppe, in this part of the world. And you will see early warning radar sites and communication sites in Belarus or White Russia, 25,000 troops and an entire fleet, the Black Sea Fleet, based in Crimea. Early warning stations in Azerbaijan. There's more than $1 billion of Russian military assistance going to Armenia to maintain its status as a Russian client state. There is an entire Russian army division in Tajikistan on the border with Afghanistan. And by the way, weren't the Americans glad they were there in 2001 when the Russians accelerated the delivery of weapons, material, and expertise to the anti-Taliban Northern Alliance of guerrillas who, with Russian help and American help, overthrew the Taliban in Kabul in 6 weeks? Okay? So Russia has been attempting to maintain the external border of the Soviet Union as its actual security frontier, akin to American policy historically in Central America and the Caribbean, I would say. It's a realistic comparison. Keep in mind, in 1988, the limits of Soviet Russian influence in Europe ran through the heart of Germany and the Elbe River, right here along this line. 3 years later, with Soviet collapse and NATO expansion, you have that influence reduced from the heart of Germany to the Russian borders with the Baltic states, Ukraine, White Russia of 1650. I don't know if I have that map on here or not. Yes. Roughly these borders of 1650 before the accession of the Ukrainian and Russian to the Russian crowns. So in just 3 years, a collapse of 350 years of the development of Russian state influence, and in a part of the world, let's go back, in a part of the world where there are no natural lines of defense anywhere in this northern central part of Europe, most of all, including Ukraine. By the way, Ukraine, which means in Slavic languages, borderland. So Ukraine has enormous security significance for Russia. Just try to imagine the challenge of a Russian military planner trying to devise a defense of Russia when the eastern borders of Ukraine are several hundred miles only from Moscow and no natural lines of defense. Okay. This is the Sevastopol military base in the Crimean Peninsula. Now, what I'm going to show you now are the divisions of Ukraine, ethnically and linguistically, and how this also serves to intensify the Russian interest and stake in the country. I'm a little colorblind, so bear with me. This red region is mainly ethnically Ukrainian and mainly Ukrainian language dominant. These are the regions that were included into Russia last. The far western provinces only really after 1945. Galicia, Lviv, or Lvov, right? They've been part of Poland or Austria historically, mainly Roman Catholic observing the authority of the Pope in Rome, not Orthodox Greek. All right. There's a huge cultural divide as well as ethnic divide and linguistic divide. The further east you go, the more ethnically Russian Ukraine becomes, the more linguistically Russian Ukraine becomes, even amongst those who are ethnically Ukrainian. So you have roughly 11 million Russians living in the far eastern parts of Ukraine along the Russian borderlands. Mixed in, it is also true, with a significant Ukrainian population. Much more so than in the case of Crimea. Here you see a chart of Russian language use. So here in the east, almost 90%, but in the west, only 3%. I'll just leave it at that. That's pretty bipolar. Right? Those are the extreme cases. And you see also that this ethnic and linguistic gap also corresponds to an economic gap. So in the Far East, you have the richest areas as a whole, except around the capital, of Ukraine. Highest per capita income. Poorest parts tend to be in the West. The eastern parts are the most industrialized. It's the Russian Pittsburgh or upper Midwest. It's where there are huge coal deposits and thus a huge steel industry, most of which is exported to Russia. You have here a map of the grid of natural gas pipelines. Russia is the largest producer and exporter still of natural gas in the world, also of oil. Many of these run through Ukraine. Ukraine itself gets almost 80% of its natural gas from Russia, and almost half of the gas that Western Europe gets from Russia is provided by pipelines that run through Ukraine. So Ukraine is central to Russia's ability to export its oil and natural gas to Europe, and consider the economic importance of that pipeline, not just to the Russian economy, but to the Putin government itself. In recent years, half, 50% of the budget of Russia comes from receipts of oil and natural gas, and Russia's single largest customer is Western Europe, which depends on the provision of that gas through Ukraine. Here's a chart that shows in red the amount of steel that Ukraine uses internally and the amount in, I guess, blue that it exports, which has been increasing. So you see the majority of Ukrainian steel production in recent years is actually exported to the Russian market. What the chart doesn't show is that a lot of that steel in Ukraine is used in the Russian military sector to build Russian missiles, ships, tanks, so that there continues to be a huge strategic interdependence between the Ukrainian economy and the Russian military-industrial complex. Now, I mentioned the May presidential elections. Here you see the language divide, East versus West, Russian versus Ukrainian, which more or less can be overlaid on a political divide. Through 2010, this linguistic divide predicted the political results of presidential elections. Pro-Russian candidates got the lion's share of the vote in the East. Anti-Russian candidates got the lion's share of the vote in the West. This time in 2014, Poroshenko did not see a divided Ukraine. Almost all of Ukraine that voted for his government. All right, this is just a map that shows you the current areas of unrest, especially Donetsk and Luhansk. But Putin has implicitly claimed this entire area by using a term that Catherine the Great used to name this area when it was annexed from the Ottoman Empire. It is called New Russia, or Novo Russia. All right? That is a provocative term in Ukraine because it implies territorial aspirations over large parts of Ukrainian territory itself. This is a map that shows you the scenes of fighting as of early September, actions in the Labor Day weekend, which saw a reversal of these gains that the Ukrainian army had made in June and July through the middle of August. And in recent days, it appears that these rough edges have kind of been rounded out with additional Russian military assistance, basically to underscore to Kiev that it has no military option against these regions, so long as Russia is prepared to escalate and match it or exceed it whenever it wishes. And so far, it has demonstrated that will and that capability. All right. I think we have enough evidence to understand why Russia cares about Ukraine. Economically, in particular, energy, but also steel connected to its military-industrial complex. Demographically, you have 10 million ethnic Russians living outside the borders of the Russian state, right next door, in a part of the world where there had never been serious boundaries, either geographical or political. Lots of intermarriage, lots of migration. We've seen it culturally and symbolically through Christianity, through the symbolism of Kiev. 1,000 years of Russian history originates in Kiev, originates in the lands of what is today Ukraine. Now, I've suggested that we can understand the international dimensions of this crisis outside of Russia and Ukraine as a result of NATO expansion, right, coming into conflict with Russia's intent to establish itself as the dominant international power in this part of Europe. I want to advance a second thesis, and it has to do with Putin's political psychology and how it is operating within this context. You know, Karl Marx said famously that men think that they make history, but they make it within a framework that is imposed by the accumulated legacy of the past. But that's a structure. But structures don't decide. Agents decide. And there is no agent in the world today who is more decisive in his country's foreign policy than is Vladimir Putin. I think Forbes magazine recently named him the most influential leader in the world. Okay, number one. And it is largely true in terms of his capacity for influence. Therefore, it's important how Putin sees these kinds of challenges. And I want to basically make two points here. There are two elements also in Putin's psyche that are working in some tension with each other. The first is the fear of chaos, vacuums of power. Putin was a professional KGB officer. He served in East Germany in Dresden in the late 80s. He saw the communist system collapse in Eastern Germany overnight. A mob of enraged East Germans attempted to storm the KGB compound in Dresden, where he was in charge, in early December of 89. It was an extremely unsettling confrontation. Putin received no help from the local Soviet military. He said, "We have no orders. Moscow is silent." At that moment, Putin knew the system had collapsed. He saw this vacuum of authority again appear in the 90s, in the form of Russia's war in Chechnya to preserve its territorial integrity. He has seen it on numerous occasions. I won't go into the details, time permitting, but here you have a scene. Maidan Square, central Kiev, February 2014, after the rejection of the compromise deal for a transitional government and early elections. The second collapse of Putin's attempt to square Ukrainian sovereignty, however formal, with Russia's various interests. To me, this image triggers in Putin that almost atavistic concern, preoccupation with vacuums of power. And it is his task as leader of Russia to prevent those vacuums from happening again. And I think that Putin, observing these kinds of events, had reasons to conclude that in this context, Ukraine could suddenly and rapidly fall outside of Russia's orbit. It might lose its rights to base its navy in Crimea, in Sevastopol. Ukraine might gravitate toward NATO, not to mention the European Union. And therefore, Russia needed to act to save what assets it could save while it still could save them. All right, that's one part of what I think is working in Putin's mind. But there is another part. Oh, by the way, here's a picture. This is Putin in the KGB in the mid-80s. These are pictures of East Germans who had stormed the downtown East German secret police headquarters in Dresden. They had ransacked the files. They had sacked the building. And they had continued taking out the personnel files, identifying all the agents who work with the East Germans. Now they wanted the names of all the agents who work with the Soviets. So they went to Putin's compound. This is what Putin was trying to avoid. I think he sees in Maidan a reappearance of that kind of threat, all right, to the world as he defines it, his world as he defines it. This is Putin as a teenager, maybe 15. Before encountering judo, Putin was a punk, by his own admission. The word that he uses in Russian is hooligan. 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 I won't go into the psychological basis. It's a little too easy as a Freudian explanation. But when he came across judo, he saw both a way by which he could beat up, he thought, bigger boys, and he came into an encounter with a charismatic father substitute figure in the form of his coach. Very quickly, he understood judo is a discipline, a philosophy, a way of life. It's not like boxing, where you try to bring superior force to bear at a given point before your opponent can. Rather, it is about respecting the strengths of your adversary, understanding your own limitations, and deploying your adversary's advantages to your advantage, right? The judo throw, which means you must always keep your balance. Never get unbalanced. That's the only way you can throw in judo. Here, you see a much older Putin who stays in fighting trim. He has a black belt to the 8th or 9th degree. That's one level below world championship level. He was the Leningrad city champion at the university. And his coach thought if he wasn't so determined in his studies to join the KGB, he could have been the European champion and possibly the Olympic champion in 1976. He once had a match with the world champion, Karelin. And although Putin lost, he threw him once during that match. Okay? That's the level of accomplishment in judo. It is integral to his philosophy of life. So what I am suggesting is that in Ukraine, Putin is attempting to balance these twin and potentially conflicting inclinations. Fill the vacuum of power, but don't do it and in the process become unbalanced. In other words, don't send in a large Russian army directly into Ukraine, thereby perhaps triggering an open-ended resistance with outside support that could turn into another Afghanistan, which is, by the way, in my opinion, a realistic fear. Otherwise, this can happen to you. And you get thrown. This is a map that shows you the results of the May presidential elections in Ukraine. These green areas are the areas in revolt, okay, compared to the rest of Ukraine. My last point, if I were advising Mr. Putin right now, I have many things I could say to Ukraine or to the Americans, but what I would say to Mr. Putin, look at this map. Your own actions have produced this result. A Ukraine that previously was divided, east and west, is now mainly unified. All right? You have Crimea. You have a few provinces, parts of provinces, in the Far East. They've been seriously damaged by 6 months of war. There are huge costs to reconstruct them. If Russia winds up with Crimea and some devastated regions in the extreme far east of Ukraine, but loses the rest of Ukraine, is this really in Russia's interest? He's provoking a reconsolidation of NATO along Ukraine's frontiers. John McCain is going to be the next chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's already been to Kiev. He's very anxious to send heavy weaponry and anti-tank guns and anti-aircraft guns to the Ukrainian government. Well, he is. Whether he will or not is another question. But he's absolutely determined to do so. I would remind Mr. Putin of the example of American-Cuban relations. Putin has a lot of problems, as do many Russians, coming to terms with the sovereignty of Ukraine, that Ukraine really is an independent state. He told George Bush at that NATO summit in April of 08, you know, George, Ukraine isn't a real state. And many Russians do believe that quite sincerely. In other words, they don't take Ukrainian sovereignty seriously. Well, you know, neither did the United States take Cuba's sovereignty very seriously. For the 60 years or so in which the Americans had dominant influence in Cuba after the Spanish-American War, the American ambassador was always more powerful than the president of Cuba. And this helped contribute to the nationalist support for Castro's seizure of power in 1959. Continued American contempt for Cuban sovereignty helped to both accelerate Castro's alliance with the Soviet Union and helped give us the Cuban Missile Crisis. Of course, all of you are much too young to remember that, in October of 1962. I don't remember it, even though I remember Khrushchev's visit to New York in 1960, because my mother told me the parents were so scared they didn't dare talk about it in front of the children. Okay? I would tell Mr. Putin, the danger that you run is the risk of transforming Ukraine into a vast continental Cuba on the Russian frontier. Is that really where you want to wind up? What is the ultimate objective of your policy? So I'll stop there, and I'll be happy to take questions and comments.
I'm going to call him. He's fine. We're going to ask him over here.
That's fine. Okay.
Remember, the drill is that everybody asks questions, but you need to be identified and have a microphone. These are podcasts, and we want to have everything recorded. So who's the first? Where's the first hand? Back there.
My name is Jerry Schlesinger, and my question is, you made a very strong case why Russia is interested in Ukraine geopolitically, strategically, linguistically, culturally, religiously. My question to you is, why should America care? Why is America why should America be interested in Ukraine?
I can answer that in one of two ways. I can basically ask you the same question, because I basically think I share the same skepticism. But then there is the question, is why do the Americans care, right? And why should they care? Well, it's true there are, significant issues of international law and precedent at stake. You don't seize countries' territory arbitrarily by force. That was what was happened in Crimea, right? You're not supposed to use direct pressure, economic or otherwise, in order to achieve your political objectives. Right? Of course, you can look at the foreign policy of many other countries and you can draw your own conclusions about how consistent some other countries may be in that. But specifically with respect to Ukraine, all I can say, it looks like to me there is a huge institutional momentum in NATO, right, toward continual institutional expansion for justification. Mission creep, right? There are huge organizational interests and incentives in Brussels, in Washington, D.C., that continue to have a reflex that sees Russia basically as a continued adversary. And that without Ukraine, Russia cannot have any realistic chance to be an international player of significance. There's some truth in that. Insofar as that's true, it suggests that there's a kind of neo-containment policy motivating American interests. And there's enough evidence on the ground, at least to convince Russians who aren't skeptical about this in the first place. So 3 weeks before the collapse of the agreement in February, aside from John McCain, Victoria Nuland, a senior middle upper level State Department official, was visiting Kiev, and unfortunately for her, her conversation with the American ambassador was tapped, probably by Russian intelligence sources. And it's on the web. It's not been denied. And she is discussing in detail who in Ukraine would be an acceptable official of government in Kiev. And she goes right down the list, talking in detail. Okay? Actually, I think this is deeply irresponsible on the part of the United States. We have a rhetorical commitment, right, which I think is sincere. It's part of the American DNA to think that the extension of democracy around the world is the best way of providing for America's interests and values at home and so forth. But in the end, given the intensity of Russian interests that I have just outlined, what is the intensity of the American interest in Ukraine? You know, we didn't contest, really, Ukraine's integration into the Soviet Union throughout most of the Cold War. At the one moment when it was actually possible to accelerate the disintegration of the Soviet Union, in 1991, George Bush went to Kiev, Ukraine. And he told the Ukrainians, make your bed with Gorbachev. Don't secede. He warned them against what he called suicidal nationalism. The difficulty is that in holding out the prospect of NATO, in holding out the prospect that Ukraine can exit the Russian orbit, we are encouraging Ukrainians to attempt that without really having the prospect of achieving it, and thereby provoking the Russians to a conflict in which ultimately we will not be defending the Ukrainians when they have to deal with Russian wrath, which is almost completely predictable in this particular case. And we have the precedent of Georgia already before us. And as I tell my students, which do you think is more important to the Russians, Georgia or Ukraine?
Two related questions. What are the effects of the sanctions having on the Russian economy? And what pathways out of the morass are appearing, and who can implement them?
The sanctions are having a significant effect, a significant economic effect, in an economy that was already experiencing some rather serious problems before the sanctions took root. Growth was slowing down to 1% or less per year as an apparently long-term prospect in Russia. There was an acceleration of capital flight out of the country, almost twice the rate of 2013, earlier in the year, and it's continued to the present day. The sanctions are reinforcing that. Lack of sufficient capital investment, retarding the country's transformation to anything beyond a petroleum natural resource-based economy. The ruble has been devalued by about 25% in recent months. Now, there are some who benefit from that, domestic industrial producers, right? But on the whole, it helps generate inflation, and it really has devalued much more than the economic fundamentals would warrant, suggesting a real crisis of confidence in the country. So the effects are real, and the Russians acknowledge it, even Putin. But given the set of interests that I have just adumbrated for you, I do not think that these sanctions can translate politically into Russia relinquishing its set of interests in Ukraine in any way that leaves Ukraine leeway to enter NATO and the European Union in disregard for Russia's interests. All right, so that's the first part on sanctions. So I think the sanctions can have a serious effect on Russia. I don't think they can produce an outcome by themselves to this conflict. And then we should also ask ourselves the question, well, what if the sanctions did work? What if they worked massively? What if they brought the Russian economy to its knees? Well, then you would have a country occupying 1/6 of the world's land surface, bestriding Europe, the Middle East, and East Asia, with thousands of nuclear weapons, all right? A huge non-military nuclear infrastructure, biological and chemical weapons stores galore, all right? Somebody has to provide political order in that 1/6 of the world's surface. Actually, the Americans have a huge national interest, whether they realize it or not, in keeping a strong, viable Russian state, which is completely occluded by the Cold War reflexes we've been seeing operating in recent months. All right, second question. How do we get out of it? I don't know. I will say this, that it is very hard for me to see the United States playing a role for the next 2 years in that. You have what is, in effect, a lame duck president now, very lame, okay, because of the elections. Simple. I mean, even without those elections, a president in his second term, the second 2 years of his second term, he is basically loses the power to induce people to respect him. This is independent of Obama. He can't punish and he can't reward in the same degree anymore. And foreigners all know this. The headline on Le Monde, Paris, the day after the election was the end of the Obama era. All right? And the Congress is going to be staffed by Republican majorities in both houses. Aggressive Republican majorities. And on this question, they are all for militarizing the conflict. Sending heavy weaponry to Kiev, fighting the Russians. By the way, taking the president at his word when he talks about Russian aggression and Ukrainian democracy. Words which the president just drops off the tongue and then without bothering to explain, suggesting he's following an agenda set by his bureaucracy rather than imposing control over the bureaucracy. If you see a pattern there, perhaps it's not a coincidence. All right? So, I do not see an easy exit here. What is Putin's objective? I think at the most general level, it is to get the government in Kiev to accept, the Europeans to accept, and the Americans to accept that there can be no stable solution for Ukraine unless the Russians agree. Everything else is detailed to be filled in. And I think every step that Putin has taken has been aimed toward producing that effect. Of course, now, you have a lot of men with guns, some of them not so easy to control, on the ground, both sides. You've been having NATO creating a 4,000-man rapid reaction force in Eastern Europe for the first time, revolving from the Baltic states to Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, all around the Ukrainian lands. The Russians have been buzzing NATO borderlands over the last month, 40-odd air incidents, yes, okay, sending messages, reminiscent of Cold War, without the ideological element of Cold War, without the global dimension of Cold War, right? But nevertheless, you know, transacting relations through symbolic uses of force rather than through actual discussion and negotiation. I asked the Russian ambassador about what could Russia do to help resolve this crisis. His answer was nothing. We have nothing to do with it. You know, the Russian strategy is sort of like, if you remember that old terrible movie from the 60s, it was the last such movie that could ever be made. It was called How to Murder Your Wife. And Walter Matthau was in it. And he was cheating on his wife. And his friend, he was asked, what can I do if I get caught? He said, just deny. Deny everything. Total denial. Don't admit a single thing. And of course, his wife catches him in the act. In the bed. Naked. With the mistress, right? And she's accusing him. And he just, oh no, it's not happening. Nothing happened. No. Right there, goes on for 5 minutes. So finally, he denies everything. And finally, the wife says, all right, takes their arm and walks right out the door. This is Putin's strategy. It's a strategy to avoid a red line of crossing an open border. He believes that anything below that is enough to keep the West sufficiently ambiguous, ambivalent, and confused that he can make his agenda prevail.
In the 20th century, Europe was marked by a great deal of territorial dispute where Germany was trying to take it all. And at the end of the Second World War, the Marshall Plan supported Germany economically to rebuild it, and now it's an integrated part of a very unified Europe. When the Soviet Union Empire fell, could the West have done anything more to establish some sort of economic alliance that would have promoted more friendly relations between the Euro, the Eurasian, you called it the Eurasian Economic Alliance,
yes.
And the West? I'm not sure that the European Union would have wanted Russia in it, but could it have happened that we had tried to preclude all of this?
Yeah. I think the answer is no. This was Richard Nixon's last political act, to actually try and shame the Bush administration in the spring of 1992 to create a Marshall Plan for Russia, on the argument that conditions had changed dramatically and it was a huge national interest of the United States to see that Russia takes a soft landing out of communism. It's exactly along the lines that you were describing. Richard Nixon's last hurrah, actually, politically. And he did shame the Bush administration into proposing a $24 billion aid program for 1992 alone, which is pretty impressive. It's comparable to Marshall Plan sums, except when you strip it apart, it was less than $2 billion in real aid. Okay, they included debt forgiveness, that, in other words, payments that the Russians didn't make. They counted that as aid. They counted $6 billion toward a ruble stabilization fund, which was never used because the ruble was too unstable, 2,600% inflation. That was counted as aid. So it was a lot of deception. But even so, I think the problems in Russia were of such a magnitude, 150 million population, 300 million in the entire former Soviet Union, that it was most unlikely that any program could have had a stable outcome in the early to medium-term future. The mistake that we made was twofold. First of all, we didn't make all mistakes. We did recreate in Russia a single nuclear power after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. That was a huge success for American and international policy. But it came with Ukraine agreeing to transfer all of its nuclear weapons to Russia. And the Russians agreed that they would respect Ukraine's sovereignty, all right? Which shows you there can be more important things than proliferation, right? Thus, the importance of Ukraine for Russia. Not everything was a mistake, but the mistake was to identify ourselves so publicly with a process that ultimately we really couldn't shape significantly, and therefore identify the United States with the economic collapse of Russia from within in the 1990s. Russian anti-Americanism really begins from that period of time. The second mistake was to construct the post-Cold War security order in Europe, mainly through NATO, with Russia on the outside, rather than to think through a way in which Russia might be included, even if not in NATO. And I believe that was the original sin. Details aside, all right? Gorbachev thought he had a commitment in agreeing to rapid German unification in NATO in 1990, that NATO would not move one inch eastward. That's what Secretary of State Baker told him. Now, you know, NATO's defenders will say, well, that meant East Germany, not Eastern Europe, which was still in the Warsaw Pact. Technically, yes. Legally, yes. But, you know, NATO never explored with Russia. What might a common security framework mean? And I think these are the chickens coming home to roost right now.
I admire Mr. Gorbachev, and I noticed last week in an enclosure in the Washington Post,
yes,
he was asked what might have happened after what we call the Russian collapse, and we the only remaining superpower. He said, I don't think that we were duplicitous in allowing Germany to be reunited with the historical threat. I just don't believe that your country treated us with respect or acted appropriately for a great power, and that, therefore, that was the cause and perhaps the impetus for Putin trying to restore a level of respect for a world that can no longer stand a single large superpower. I'd be interested in your reaction.
Yeah, it's an important article, and if there's a way of getting it to people in the group, it would be helpful for them to read it. Gorbachev was trying to make two points in this interview. The first was to defend himself against charges that he had somehow naively agreed to NATO expansion. Okay? And what he said was, no, what we had agreed to was that NATO would not expand into former Eastern Germany.
Militarily.
Correct. NATO forces. And he said, and that hasn't happened, and that's been observed. So we got that, okay? Now, the second point was directed against the West, which and the Americans in particular, which was that they have tried to organize European security basically on a take-it-or-leave-it basis for Russia. And that whatever the specific nature of the pledges or given or not in 1990, the actions taken by NATO ever since have reflected that line of development. And I think that's accurate. That is accurate. And I want to stress the damage was done before Putin came to power. There was an effort to bring Russia in a side door. In 1997, NATO took, you can still hear me through the mic, NATO took the decision to include Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. In 1999, they came in. A treaty was signed with Russia and NATO. Exchange of ambassadors, councils, committees of collaboration, and NATO gave Russia assurances. Number one, NATO is a defensive organization, not an offensive organization. NATO doesn't operate beyond the territory, the boundaries of existing member states. And of course, we will always consult the Russians on matters of importance to Russia in European security. 2 years later, March of 99, NATO launched an air war against Serbia. We can discuss later the justification of the action, but outside the UN Security Council, where the Russians have a veto, precisely to avoid a Russian veto, against strenuous Russian opposition. And it is that war that it clarified for Russia what NATO expansion meant. It meant that NATO reserved the right unto itself to determine how, when, where military force would or wouldn't be used in post-Cold War Europe. And that was before Putin came to power, while Bill Clinton was still president of the United States. You know, you could say the main difference between Bill Clinton and George W. Bush is that for the Clinton administration, the slogan was multilateral where we can, unilateral where we must. For Bush, it was unilateral where we can, multilateral where we must. You know, and one more point. Cheney had an interview with Gorbachev around 2006-07. It was published in the Wall Street Journal. And Gorbachev told Cheney, who was still VP, you know, Mr. Cheney, don't you think you Americans might be able to get better results from your foreign policy at a lower cost if you took other countries' interests into account, for example, Russia's? And Cheney said no. He said explicitly no. We squeezed the Soviet Union into the Cold War until we prevailed, and there's no reason why that strategy won't work now. There we are. Yes, thank you.
With the ascendancy of McCain to chairman of the military, foreign, whatever, committee, are we going to see, in your opinion, the neocons begin to creep back out of the woodwork?
Well, they won't be in the administration, for sure, right?
Right.
And the neocons suffered a serious defeat because of the costs of implementing the Iraq policy. They were already being forced out of the second Bush administration because the costs of their policy were just so high. And I had colleagues of mine, moderate Republicans like Paul Stephen in the law school, Philip Zelikow in the history department, going back into the State Department, what I would call the return of the adults to government, right, in 2005. And 2006. The neocons are not going back to the Obama administration. And they went, well, there's some question about influence in the State Department. The Victoria Nuland network is connected to the neoconservative network already. Okay, her husband, Robert Kagan, is maybe the leading intellectual in the neoconservative foreign policy movement, all right, within the existing Obama administration. There will be huge pressure coming from the Senate, no question, to advance, accelerate, expand military assistance to Ukraine. And it will be a test of the president's skills, his political skills, as a lame duck. How can he contain that? They will try to put riders on various budget bills.
They'll try to make hostages of things the president holds dear by making it dependent upon aid to Ukraine. You can be sure. So there's going to be a number of political showdowns over this question. And the Republicans are going to feel emboldened by the electoral results over this. McCain, his chief foreign policy advisor, a gentleman named Randy Scheuneman, was the chief lobbyist for the Republic of Georgia before 2008. He was the one encouraging the Georgians into NATO and basically provoking them into a disastrous war with the Russians. That is John McCain's leading foreign policy advisor. He will be advising McCain on these issues. So expect to see a lot of confrontation.
I read an article this summer. I believe the author was Michael Roskin. There seems to be a school of political scientists who consider themselves very pragmatic. And his point was that it would be more in the interest of the United States to allow Russia its buffer zone because the stakes are so high.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you phrase it in this way, it can hardly be controversial, right? Russia is still a power of enormous import in the world. It is true, by the way, that if you define this strictly in terms of a certain liberal morality of international law, every country should have the right to choose their own political system and their foreign alliances. Well, it is true. If every country along Russia's borders really believed that they were free to choose with no consequences from Russia, they would all join NATO. They would. Just as every Latin American country, if they really thought they were free to choose, would find a way to, let's say, diversify their dependence on the United States. The Mexicans have an expression, I'll translate it immediately. Pobre México, tan lejos del Dios, tan cerca a los Estados Unidos, which means poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States of America, right? Ukrainians can sympathize with that situation. Poles can sympathize with that situation. You know, the Poles were in an awful position in the 1930s, caught between Stalin and Hitler. We can understand their paralysis. We can understand their magical thinking that somehow the Western democracies would save Poland from agonizing choices. But they couldn't. There's no way that they could. Poland's only choice was to cut a deal with Russia somehow, to avoid the worst at the hands of the Nazis. That's a horrible choice. But it's a choice that is made within a world of realities. Can we really imagine that the American people are willing to pay the price, economic price, the military price, to secure Ukrainian independence from Russian influence? I think not. And therefore, under those circumstances, the question is, how can we get ourselves to do what is so obvious, which we need to find a way so that Ukraine need not choose between Russia and the West, so that Ukraine can choose its natural economic interdependency with Russia without having to foreclose its interest in developing relations with Europe and the outside world, and vice versa. In other words, I think the single most important thing Americans could do is to think not how to punish Russia, but how to help Ukraine. But you know, if you begin to start thinking like that, and then you start adding up the bill, I mean, Ukraine is like adding 7 new Greeces to the European Union. 46 million people, a bankrupt economy, a completely obsolete infrastructure, all right? Economic dependency on Russia that's not going to go away. Right? You are basically adding an international welfare case of the first magnitude for probably the next half century. But it would be a useful exercise in values clarification.
Don Lipsch, I just wonder why Russia has not made more of an issue of the energy that it supplies to the European Union. The cold is coming. The industry needs the energy.
Yes.
When are they going to use that item?
The energy card is a little bit like an economic nuclear bomb. Its value disappears as soon as you lose it. You use it. In 2006, the Russians cut off, as you obviously know, their supply of natural gas to Ukraine in early January, in the dead of winter. Okay. Ukraine, to defend itself, siphoned off the gas that was supposed to go through Ukraine to Europe and kept it for themselves, understandably. But now the Europeans are freezing. So the European Union intervened and basically politely knocked heads together and told the Russians, you can't behave like this. We need to find some way out. And within 2 weeks, the crisis was over. And it had backfired on the Russians. They had attempted to isolate Ukraine, to show Ukraine it had no option other than Moscow. But actually, the crisis triggered European Union intervention, showing that Ukraine's security was a matter of all European interest. All right. But if at first you don't succeed, 3 years later, Putin does the same thing again, with the same consequences, European Union intervenes. Putin's overall diplomacy is based upon not having to deal with a unified European Union. Because if Russia does have to deal with a unified European Union, it can't win those negotiations. Europe is far too wealthy. It will be far too unified. All right? You know, it's the largest market for Russia. More than 50% of the value of Russian exports comes from European markets. But only 5% of the value of European exports comes from the Russian market. That's a 10-to-1 discrepancy. So Putin must make sure that the Europeans stay divided enough so that he can play off them one by one. Were he to use this card, it would trigger that monolithic opposition, which would undercut his entire basic diplomatic foundation. So I will say an item of news. In the last week, the Russians did sign a deal with the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians agreed to pay $4 billion in arrears to the Russians. That gives them energy over the winter. But where is that $4 billion going to come from? It's going to come from the IMF. It's going to come from you, all right, your taxes, all right? And it's going to wind up in Mr. Putin's pocket. That's where we are.
You have
5 minutes.
Okay, we have a good picture here of the historical forces and the sphere of interest and all the concerns that the Russians have and Putin has and all that. But wouldn't many of the people in Ukraine, the Western-oriented ones and their leaders, say this, that yes, indeed, you're right that we have a disaster here economically. It's been a basket case, a kleptocracy, corruption, and all the rest. And yet we look to other nations that were in the Soviet Union and how they have done, Poland, for example, and others that were also in pretty bad shape. But in connection with the European Union, they've come a long, long way. And this is our best hope, they're thinking, that if we're going to make it and economically in the future, it's not with ties to Russia. It's with ties to the western part of Europe, and this is the hope.
Yes, that's an understandable argument. And the question is, how do you get from here to there, right? How do you get to there when, for the foreseeable future, in the best case, Ukraine will remain disproportionately dependent upon the Russian export market, okay? Ukraine remains tied into the Russian military-industrial economy. You have a large part of the population in the East that does not share the historical identity of the Western Ukrainians, which are much more closely identified with Moscow than they are with Western Europe. So I come back to my earlier point. Any policy, I think, first has to be based, how do you help Ukraine as opposed to how do you punish Russia? Ukraine can only be helped if Russia, Europe, the Americans, and the Ukrainians are working together. If they're working across purposes, the Ukrainians are going to be the ones paying the highest price. That is, after all, the privilege of great powers, right, to offload the cost of their decisions upon weaker partners. And I think, therefore, an ethics of responsibility implies also that we understand the implications of power politics, that is, a kind of Kantian ethics of consequences and not just the ethics of intentions.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.